I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last night, President Trump picked Brett Kavanaugh to be his nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court, filling the seat of retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy. Kavanaugh has been a judge on the powerful D.C. Court of Appeals for 12 years. Flanked by his family and Trump, he said an independent judiciary is the crown jewel of our constitutional republic and explained his judicial philosophy this way.
My judicial philosophy is straightforward. A judge must be independent and must interpret the law, not make the law. A judge must interpret statutes as written, and a judge must interpret the Constitution as written, informed by history and tradition and precedent.
He also spoke about the important women in his life, his mother, wife, and two daughters, and noted that the majority of his law clerks have been women. There was much speculation and drama about Trump's Supreme Court pick, his second since taking office, and there is sure to be a fight when Kavanaugh is questioned by the Judiciary Committee. The Republicans hold a slim majority in the Senate, and a multi-million-dollar ad campaign has already been targeting vulnerable Senate Democrats. Well, here to talk about all of this is Laura Little. She is the James G. Schmidt Professor of Law and Senior Advisor to the Dean at Temple University School of Law. She previously served as a law clerk to Chief Justice William Rehnquist, and she has a forthcoming book, believe it or not, on law and comedy. Laura Little, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
Also with us, Michael Moreland. He is University Professor of Law and Religion and Director of the Eleanor H. McCullen Center for Law, Religion, and Public Policy at Villanova University's Charles Widger School of Law. Michael Moreland, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Questions or comments to join our conversation. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Laura, let me begin with you, but Michael, I want to have you weigh in on this as well. Would a President Romney or a President McCain have picked Judge Kavanaugh?
I think that's quite possible. That is, he Judge Kavanaugh has lived his adult life sort of focused on this moment, and he has the credentials that would put him within the close field of hopefuls for I think any Republican president.
And he was on this list from the Federalist Society. Does this picked surprise you at all, Michael?
Not at all. 5 years ago, if you'd asked me if there's a Republican president who would be the possible candidates, and at the top of the list, I would have said Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch.
Oh, interesting. And you worked a bit in the White House with Kavanaugh.
I did. I was a lawyer on the domestic policy staff while he was the staff secretary, and he was very, very well regarded then, and it was to no one's surprise that he was nominated to the D.C. Circuit and then was under consideration for the Supreme Court.
Laura, what do you make, and I don't want to make too much of the fact that he did call out and stress the women in his life. He said he loved his father, and that's always good to know.
Right.
But at the same time, he seemed to go out of his way to say something about or maybe for women. Do you interpret that any which way?
Well, I mean, I take it as a public relations move. That is to make clear that in fact he supports half the population, and maybe to suggest in an oblique way that he could vote in favor of women's rights in ways that we might not anticipate given his other political dispositions.
Did you read anything into that, Michael?
Well, judges aren't political, but they're confirmed in a political process, and this confirmation battle will be a political process. And so, it's to his benefit to emphasize the fact that he's open-minded in various ways and has a broad constituency in support of his confirmation.
Laura, do you see a big fight over Roe coming up?
I certainly think it's going to be at the top of the agenda in terms of the topics during the confirmation hearings, probably during his private meetings with the senators. Whether whether it's going to make or break the nomination, it's hard to predict. I think that on the subject of Roe, it's not the same as other president that has been sort of at play in Supreme Court confirmation hearings. But there are some similarities in that it's been around for a very, very long time.
Since
the early 70s. And so it's very much a part of American culture. And to overrule Roe might be unsettling in a way that perhaps the conservatives don't want. At the moment, it's a great rallying cry and a great organizing principle. And once that goes away, yes, there'll be abortion fights in the states, but it may be something that's harder to get rid of than one might think.
Do you see risks if Roe is overruled? Do you see risks?
I guess I agree with Laura. I don't think that it's not like the day after he's confirmed that Roe will be overturned. I think that, you know, the sequence of cases from Roe to Casey to Whole Women's Health a couple years ago, it's kind of a ramshackle series of constitutional doctrines that allow states to restrict or not restrict abortion in various ways. I do suspect that as these cases come up, that there will now be a majority to be more open to states restricting abortion. But I don't think the court's going to grab out to overturn Roe anytime precipitously.
So Roe is sort of taken apart but not gotten rid of?
Well, in some ways it already has been.
Through Casey, right?
And the subsequent decisions, because it's a very, I would say, unstable area of constitutional law, because it leaves so much up to judges under this undue burden standard and so forth. And so that's where I think a lot of the fight in litigation about abortion in the next few years will be. It won't be squarely about whether Roe will survive as a precedent or not. And I think that's important for people to understand that that's not really the primary question here.
He's issued something like 300 opinions. He did rule in a case involving a pregnant, undocumented teenager. She wanted an abortion. I think she was 17 years old at the time. She was 15 weeks pregnant, as I understand it. He opposed it, and apparently the D.C. Court of Appeals ruled for the teenager. He dissented on that, talking about abortion on demand. But let me also read something that he said back in 2006 when Senator Chuck Schumer asked him, "Do you consider Roe v. Wade to be an abomination?" He replied, "I would follow Roe v. Wade faithfully and fully. That would be binding precedent of the court." Picking up on what you said, Laura, about precedent and Roe, how do we reconcile, or can we reconcile, these two opinions or decisions?
Well, first of all, what he said in his confirmation hearing when he was being considered for the D.C. Circuit, it's not going to bind him now. He was trying to get a job as a lower court judge.
And so he was saying that to mollify Schumer?
No, I mean, he was saying that because a lower court judge has to follow the precedent of the United States Supreme Court, right, and he doesn't have the prerogative to overturn Roe or to suggest it's not good law. As a Supreme Court justice, he has a very different role to play and a lot more latitude. So I don't think you can put much weight in what he testified in his prior confirmation hearing. In terms of the immigration case,
right,
I think that he had some pretty strong language there that is suggestive of his jurisprudential view of the abortion right. But at the same time, it was a very specific set of factual circumstances that you could easily confine to that area.
Is it fair to ask a nominee, Michael, what their opinion is about Roe?
I think these nominees, and this has been true for decades now, have to toe a very careful line. On the one hand, they can't commit themselves to the outcome of cases that might come before them. But on the other hand, it's certainly fair for senators to ask them about their views about precedent, about, you know, whether, I mean, Senator Spector a decade ago talked about super precedent and what they think about those. But I also think it's important not to commit yourself one way or another on a particular case that might come before the court.
And can we believe them when they say they will abide by precedent or call balls and strikes, as the Chief Justice said when he was being confirmed or under questioning?
Well, and this gets into the technical legal term we have, is stare decisis, right? When precedent is followed and when it's overturned. And there are a lot of factors in play, right? No one is committed extremely one way or the other. No one says you can never overturn precedent or revisit precedent, and no one says you always have to follow it. So I do think that, exploring his views about that question will certainly be probably part of the hearings.
Yeah. What do you think, Laura?
Well, there's been a very, very strong trend, really, since the Robert Bork hearings, for potential nominees to duck any discussion of social issues, of very specific constitutional issues and the like, and to speak instead on approach to precedent, to various, you know, jurisprudential broad concepts. And I think that that's contrary to what the framers intended. That is, the Constitution sets up a politicized process. That is, the idea that the president is in a different place than the Senate, that must give its advice and consent. And given that we're talking about someone that's going to have a job for life, it's very important to be actually very upfront about debating real issues so that the public has a better understanding of what they're getting.
But are you saying that the senators need to ask better questions or different kinds of questions, or there needs to be more back and forth?
I'm saying that I don't think it's consistent with the constitutional process for nominees to stand behind a shield that says, well, I might get that case while I'm on the court, so I can't even touch the particular legal issue. I totally agree with the idea that they can't pledge to take a particular position, because that would threaten their impartiality. But these are real social issues that inform legal decision-making that should be aired.
We're almost having a break here. Michael, what do you think about that?
I agree with a lot of that. I mean, I think that, you know, this abortion issue is still, to take that as a particular precedent, is obviously still very prominent. I think it's important that this wouldn't be so much in the hearings, maybe, but in the wider debate, we understand that even if Roe were overturned, which again I don't think is going to be the first thing that happens, that would return it to the political process, and I think the states would vary considerably. But I think that on the question of sort of judicial philosophy, that's where I think the hearings will mostly be focused, and that will be a way of being able to glean a little bit about where Judge Kavanaugh will come out on things.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Michael Moreland, professor of law at Villanova University, and Laura Little, she's a professor of law at Temple University, talking about the fact that the president has selected a nominee to fill the seat of Anthony Kennedy on the U.S. Supreme Court. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we are talking about the fact that last night President Trump picked Brett Kavanaugh to be his nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court. Here's Senator Cory Booker. He was commenting after the announcement last night, and he was on MSNBC's Rachel Maddow show.
This is a person that's going to roll back so many of the freedoms and liberties that Americans have gained for themselves over the 50 years, whether it's a woman's right to make her own medical decision, whether it's voting rights, whether it's the right for workers to organize, whether it's the right for individuals to have the rights of citizenship, like voting rights. There are so many things here that should be objectionable to, again, people on both sides of the aisle.
Laura, do you agree with Senator Booker?
I think it's true that we are going to have a trend to the right if, in fact, he is confirmed. But there might be an overstatement in terms of how liberal Justice Kennedy was. He was not a liberal, right? He was a swing vote, but he swung left and he swung right. So on many issues, it's not that dramatic of a change. But I think that it's correct that Kavanaugh's record on voting rights suggests that, in fact, he's not a big proponent of judicial intervention, federal judicial intervention. But then Kennedy wasn't that strong on that topic either. And there's a lot of areas where our evidence on what Kavanaugh would do is actually quite thin. We don't really know where he stands on
gay. In spite of all those opinions.
Right? gay rights, the death penalty, those are issues for which we really don't have a lot of data.
What do you think, Michael? And what do you think the Democrats can do? They are in the minority.
They only have 49 votes, and I do think they might be overplaying their hand here a little bit. I mean, not only by virtue of the fact they're in the minority, but also before we've even had hearings or a really thorough vetting of Judge Kavanaugh to say that he'll do all these things and that he will, you know, that we'll all vote no. I think we need to let the process play out a little more fully in that regard. Laura's right. I mean, one thing is that being a judge on the D.C. Circuit means that you handle a lot of big technical administrative law cases, but you often don't have a lot of hot button issues come up. Sometimes you do. We mentioned the immigration case earlier. So that again will be another issue that will be played out.
Well, people, did you want to say something?
I was just going to add, in terms of the technical governmental cases that come to the D.C. Circuit, his approach to the power of agencies has sort of very, very consistently come out in favor of supporting big business. Mm. So we can definitely see that trend in his approach in the D.C. Circuit.
Well, a lot is being made of an article he wrote in the Minnesota Law Review, I should say, that he was part of Ken Starr, the special investigator's team investigating President Bill Clinton at the time. He was part of that. And in 2009, wrote an article for the Minnesota Law Review. I won't quote the whole thing. I'll just pull out a couple of comments there. But he talked about the fact that the executive should be exempt from, quote unquote, time-consuming and distracting lawsuits and investigations, which would ill serve the public interest, especially in times of financial or national security crisis. Michael, how do you interpret that?
Well, I think it's important to point out that what Judge Kavanaugh said there at the start of the Obama administration, by the way, in 2009, was that Congress should enact laws to insulate the executive from certain kinds of criminal investigations and otherwise that might interfere with the president's ability to carry out his duties. And that's an issue on which people can have, I think, good faith disagreement. I think it's to his credit, actually, that as a well-known conservative judge, he was saying at the start of the Obama administration, we need actually to protect the executive more from this kind of interference.
And you think he was referring to what happened under Ken Starr, his boss, and the Clinton administration?
I think he was reflecting some on that experience. Yes.
How do you interpret this?
Well, I think it's probably was a feather in his cap in terms of Trump's evaluation of his candidacy. That is, the idea that he has this disposition towards protecting the president from sort of very intrusive investigation, I would think would be very appealing to Trump given his particular situation. Beyond that, it's hard to know what he would exactly do with specific cases that come before the court. But on the other hand, you do have him saying that in the context of the Starr report, that lying to the public is an impeachable offense. So in that way, that's a counterweight in terms of his attractiveness to Trump, I would think.
But is he saying, as Nixon said, if the president does it, it's legal? Is he saying that, or is he being more nuanced, Laura?
I think what you're asking is, does he believe that, in fact, it's a crime?
Right.
That's one question, and
right.
I think the answer to that would be no. But it's one thing for it to not be a crime. It's another thing for it to be an impeachable act.
Which does raise some interesting questions about assuming he makes it to the court. As we know, Trump is under investigation by Robert Mueller. There are questions about the emoluments clause and Trump's business interests. There are questions about his nonprofit, the Trump Organization. And, of course, there are these lawsuits that are making their way through the court. Michael, do you think if any of these make it up to the U.S. Supreme Court, assuming that Kavanaugh is a justice, he would have to recuse himself?
I don't think so, and I guess I'm not as cynical maybe as others are about who these people are and the role that they take on. I mean, look, when the Nixon tapes case was decided, that was a court that President Nixon had made a number of appointments to, and it's kind of ridiculous to expect that as presidents make appointments to the court that there won't be separation of powers issues that come before the court. But I have a lot of confidence in the integrity of all nine members of the court, assuming Judge right. Kavanaugh is confirmed, in their ability to navigate those questions.
Do you share that same confidence?
Well, I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we didn't acknowledge that as human beings, justices probably have a strong pull of loyalty to the president that, in fact, gave them this fabulous prize, that is the Supreme Court justiceship, so that's going to be at play. That's one question, and we should be vigilant of it. It's another question whether or not it merits recusal, which, in fact, handicaps the business of the court.
what would be the criteria then for a recusal? Or do we have one?
Well, I mean, the idea is that their impartiality is threatened. They have inside information that mm-hmm. they shouldn't have in terms of the merits of a case. So there are very specific factors, but the idea of whether or not, in fact, they're truly biased is a little bit hard to pin down.
Let me go back to the original quote that we played from Kavanaugh, saying a judge must be independent, must interpret the law, not make the law. A judge must interpret statutes as written, and a judge must interpret the Constitution as written. Then he goes on to say, informed by history and tradition and precedent. Is he an originalist, Michael, or a variation of an originalist?
I think a variation of originalist. I mean, I think that by virtue of saying that the Constitution should be interpreted as written, but also in the light of precedent and so forth, he's qualifying that somewhat. But I do think that in other writings and in the opinions that he's written on the D.C. Circuit, he does have a commitment to an interpretation of the Constitution as written, which, of course, has been sort of a lodestar for a lot of conservative right. legal scholars and judges for decades now.
What do you think?
Well, I think a lot of his opinions show willingness to use a number of different tools for interpretation that has more of a pragmatism than is usually associated with originalism. Most of what you just read, I think, is a platitude. I think most Supreme Court nominees say something like that. But I agree with the notion that the reference to the Constitution as written is a tip of the hat to originalism. And the problem with originalism, I think, is that it's a code for conservative politics. Mm. So in that way, it may have more meaning than what meets the eye.
And by conservative politics, how do you mean that?
That is, that very often when a judge or a justice speaks in terms of hewing close to what the framers actually intended, that's something that recently has been associated with the conservative end of the spectrum in terms of social issues.
He is a conservative judge.
Yes.
Yes, I do think his methodology is conservative. I think that was apparent in some of his comments last night. But in some ways, this is a substantive debate we have to have as a country and that the Judiciary Committee will have with Judge Kavanaugh in the hearings about what we think the best approach to the Constitution is. And the president ran, in part, with an earlier version of this list and saying, these are the kinds of judges I want to appoint, and these are the kinds of methods of constitutional interpretation that I think are important for judges to have. And he won.
Yeah. And he did say, the president said last night, I mean, that picking someone to sit on the Supreme Court is one of the most consequential things that a president gets to do.
It is. It's certainly a legacy that
outlives them, right?
Outlives them. And these court fights, as Laura knows, I mean, going at least back to Nixon, but in some ways really accelerating with the Bork nomination in 1987. I mean, these have been, mm-hmm. again, not that the judges are political so much, but they do come through a political process.
Yeah. I saw a couple of opinion pieces about perhaps it's time to institute term limits. That I guess back in the, you know, when we were founded as a country, people lived to be about 35 years old or maybe 40 if they were lucky. Now, of course, we've got justices. I think Ginsburg is 85 and someone else is 80. I forget who that is. But nonetheless, we have old people sitting on the court. Is that an argument for term limits?
That's a perennial suggestion. It comes up, you know, maybe every 5 years. I think the last time I heard it argued was when Chief Justice Rehnquist was still on the bench and was very sick. And then a little, you know, if you go back even farther, when Thurgood Marshall was very, very sick, there was a suggestion that the notion of life tenure just doesn't work these days for the reasons that you say, that people are holding on.
And live for a really long time. That's Laura Little. She's a professor of law at Temple University. Also with us, Michael Moreland, and he's a professor of law at Villanova University. Both of them joining us today in Radio Times to talk about the fact that last night President Trump picked Brett Kavanaugh to be his nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court. He's been a judge on the powerful, as it's often described, D.C. Court of Appeals for 12 years. He worked in the Bush II White House. He was also a member of Ken Starr's team that investigated President Bill Clinton. We want to hear from you. What do you make of this choice, and what do you hope he is asked in the nomination process, and how do you view the U.S. Supreme Court? That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. A tweet from Brendan: should Trump be allowed to name a justice when he's under investigation, and said the judge may decide his fate? We touched on that earlier. I do want to raise something else, though, that I think Trump uniquely does. And he criticizes specific judges. He criticizes the judiciary if they make decisions that he does not agree with. He went after Judge Coryell, who made a ruling on the Trump University case, talking about him being unfair as a judge. He's gone after judges in the judiciary dealing with DACA and some other decisions about the Muslim ban. How do you feel about that, Michael?
I think personal attacks on judges are out of bounds and should rightly be regarded as that. That's different, though, than presidents or political leaders criticizing courts. Lincoln criticized the Supreme Court for Dred Scott. FDR criticized the court for striking down New Deal legislation. And President Obama in the State of the Union address criticized the Supreme Court for Citizens United. So I think it's we should be careful not to sort of be overly deferential to the Supreme Court on these questions. But I do think that personal attacks are obviously very much out of bounds.
What do you think? And I should add that Justice Ginsburg was pretty critical of the president, and he fought back.
So I totally agree that personal interchanges are unbecoming of the presidency. I also think it's inappropriate for the president to try to bully judges into ruling one way versus another. I think that threatens the independence of the judiciary, and it doesn't show adequate respect for the role of the judge. But at the same time, I agree with the idea that it's important to discuss issues, right, and to bring things into the public view, so that talking about a particular decision and what it means for American law, I think, is a healthy thing, so long as it doesn't pass the line of being a bully.
Speaking of politics, what do you make of the fact that Merrick Garland never got a hearing when he was President Obama's nominee?
Extraordinary. That is that, in fact, his nomination sort of lay languid, never got out of committee for over a year, and it seems to me that it wasn't an adequate respect for the nomination and confirmation process.
How do you see that, Mike?
Well, I mean, I'm a little more conservative on these things.
Yes, you are. One of the reasons you're here.
And the fact is that if you have a majority in the Senate, you get to do things that if you're in the minority, you can't. And the fact is that
this is pretty unprecedented. Understand.
They could have had a hearing. They could and voted him down on the floor. In some ways, maybe that would have been a fair and more transparent process to just reject his nomination outright. Judge Garland, for whom I have great respect, a very well respected member of the D.C. Circuit. But on the other hand, this was again an issue on which there are real differences between the parties, and Leader McConnell very quickly said that they would not consider an Obama nominee, and they had the majority to do that. I am sorry that we've gotten to this point in the judicial confirmation process, and there's a lot of back and forth about who started what. It's like toddlers fighting in a sandbox. But I do think that the fact that the Republicans held up that nomination does not bother me to the extent that I know it does a lot of people.
Well, what McConnell says is we'll let the people decide, because there was an election coming, and now it seems like there's always an election coming. Does that make him a hypocrite?
It was the end of – I mean, we can slice and dice this a lot of ways. Okay. It was the end of the term of a lame duck president with a presidential election on the horizon. Now we're not even halfway through the term of a first-term president with a midterm election coming up. Again, I wish we had a better way of dealing with this, but that's the way it works.
What do you see?
Well, I think that it's a little harder to distinguish the two circumstances, because the midterm election potentially could have the people speaking in a particular way, which bears on whether or not they would like this nominee.
Because so it's not about the presidency, it's about Congress.
At this point, yes. Yeah. So I think what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander, you know, in terms of – I don't think the two circumstances are that different.
So do the Democrats have any moves, as you see it, Laura?
The only thing I can anticipate is that the paper trail of Judge Kavanaugh is so significantly large that the Democrats could possibly try to slow things down in terms of going through those many, many documents that he's generated in his legal career, potentially to get beyond the midterm.
Oh. What do you think?
I think that we'll see what the document production looks like and how complicated it is. But the Democrats are hemmed in here. They only have 49 votes, starting with Senator Reid and then continuing with Senator McConnell. The filibuster limitations on confirmations have all been done away with now.
And that was Senator Reid did that?
The Senator Reid initially as to all nominations except the Supreme Court, and then Senator McConnell did that when the Democrats filibustered Justice Gorsuch's nomination. And there's also pressure, though, on some of these Democrats running for reelection this fall in states like Indiana, North Dakota, Montana, Missouri, where they will be under tremendous pressure to vote for the president's nominee because the president carried a lot of those states very handily.
And there's a giant fundraising operation that's going into effect targeting very specific Democrats in those very specific states.
Right. Just as there's also even before the nomination, there was a big ad campaign directed at Senator Collins and Senator Murkowski to defect from the Republicans. So both sides are ready for battle.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We got some folks that want to join us as well. We are talking about President Trump's pick to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh, talking with Michael Moreland, professor of law at Villanova University, Laura Little, professor of law at Temple University, and you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Those were protesters outside of the U.S. Supreme Court last night protesting the selection of Brett Kavanaugh to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's our conversation today in Radio Times. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Picking up on what we said earlier, Ruth emailed, I like former Justice John Paul Stevens' idea of 18 years on the Supreme Court, then returning to another federal court, something we mentioned earlier. Let me get Pamela from, looks like Havertown, to join our conversation. And Pamela, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Hi there, Pamela. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I have difficulty understanding.
The question is, what doesn't Kavanaugh? Why doesn't what Kavanaugh have
what
written about presidents
Kavanaugh
and investigations tell us
in his law
how
review
he'd rule on that kind
about
of
a sitting
case?
President never
That's something
being
we touched earlier. I mean, I think there's some question about what he said and what he meant and how that would apply today. You're nodding your head there.
I think so. I mean, again, I want to underscore the point. In that Minnesota Law Review piece, he said Congress is the body that he thinks should enact legislation to protect the presidency. He didn't say anything, as far as I'm aware, I haven't looked at it recently, but about, you know, how court should rule in these kinds of cases. Nor did he call for reversing the Supreme Court's decision in the Paula Jones case, where the court unanimously held that the president was subject to civil investigation.
Civil damages for actions before he became president.
Right. But does it tell us something about how he thinks about executive power?
Well, he seems to have a very, very broad view of executive power. You can see that in his decisions respecting executive agencies. You could see that in a number of his extrajudicial writings, law reviews, et cetera.
What would you want to ask him? If you were sitting on the Senate Judiciary Committee, what would you want to ask him?
Will you overrule Roe?
I mean, truly, you feel like this is that's sort of the heart, the crux of the matter. How about for you, Michael?
I think it's always helpful to hear more about how a judge thinks about approaching legal questions, about interpretive methods, the role of history and precedent, because I don't think you get answers, again, for decades to whether or not a case will be overruled, because, as Laura said earlier, if they commit themselves that way, in some ways it damages their impartiality.
Would you want to ask about privacy? I mean, that was one of the things, I guess, that led to Roe, was the Griswold case having to do with privacy. I mean, is there kind of an end run around your question to get
sure,
to what you want?
Sure. I mean, that is the constitutional basis for Roe involves a whole way of thinking about how to interpret various Bill of Rights and understanding how broadly he would interpret those and whether he embraces something called substantive due process, which is very much the basis for the gay rights decisions, the gay marriage decisions, as well as the reproductive rights decisions. That would be suggestive of what he would do with the particular case. I personally would just like to see how he would answer that question, however, whether he would be willing to give some sort of glimmer about his view of reproductive rights.
I wonder about gay rights, even the Obergefell decision, that's not as old as Roe, and that's something that Justice Kennedy supported. Do you see that, Michael, as in someone's crosshairs?
I don't see much political pressure to revisit Obergefell. It is more recent, and it was, of course, controversial, 5-4 at the time. But I don't see a lot of jurisprudential or political traction in revisiting Obergefell or Lawrence versus Texas or that series of cases.
One issue in particular with the marriage decision, that's the Obergefell decision, is that people have relied on it. People have gotten married, right? And if, in fact, you return the issue to the states so that, again, we're back in a situation where there's a lot of diversity in terms of state laws, it creates a huge mess in terms of people's lives, in terms of federalism, in the relationship of various state laws. So there's practical consequences of overruling those decisions that you might not get in other civil rights areas.
I mean, what would you do with those people who got married?
That's right.
Do you unmarry them or what? Do you see it that way too, Michael?
I do. I think that's right. And I think where there will continue to be some cases coming before the court, and again, I don't expect Judge Kavanaugh would commit himself one way or the other on these, but last time I was here, we talked about Masterpiece Cake Shop. But I do think there will be more cases about freedom of speech and free exercise of religion in the context of anti-discrimination law. The court in Masterpiece Cake Shop this year put off the big issues. So I do think those issues will continue to come to the court.
In fact, the court seemed sort of tossed that back to Colorado and said that the Civil Rights Commission seemed to have a kind of animus against religion, the religion of the cake shop owner.
Right, and they put off the larger free speech question.
Do you see that making its way back to the court?
Yes, I do. And I think to the extent we have any glimmer of what Judge Kavanaugh believes in terms of the Constitution's relation to religion, he did decide one very significant issue in terms of the religious rights of corporations, in terms of the contraception issue. So we do have a sense that he'll be very, very, very involved with that particular issue.
Do you see the Affordable Care Act coming under fire then? Again, this is making the assumption he's going to be confirmed.
He had two major Affordable Care Act cases. One was the contraception case, right? But in that instance, he was focused on religion rather than focused on whether or not, in fact, it was within Congress's power. In the second case, he had the opportunity to address that issue, but he took what, you know, in law you might call an off-ramp. That is, he took another route to basically duck the issue and said that under a technical provision called the Anti-Injunction Act, that in fact the case shouldn't have gone forward.
A comment from Roger. He said, I'd like to comment on the sameness of all the justices in the SCOTUS pipeline. There are 200 law schools in the country, but all of the justices are from Harvard or Yale. They're either Catholic or Jewish. What does that tell us, Michael?
Well, Justice Gorsuch attends an Episcopalian church.
Oh, he does. Okay.
But he was raised as a Catholic.
Justice
Ginsburg,
Episcopal is like that far from Catholic.
I think Justice Ginsburg finished at Columbia, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. So that's. But there is a kind of a sameness, wouldn't you say?
There is. And I think people made the point, even among the four finalists that were being bandied about, that that one, Ray Kethledge, was a graduate of Michigan, from Michigan. Tom Hardiman from Pittsburgh was a Georgetown law grad. Amy Barrett on the Seventh Circuit was a Notre Dame law grad. And that geographic and educational and even life background diversity, so politicians who used to be somewhat routinely appointed to the court, but now we don't have any politicians on the court. And I think other than Justice Sotomayor, no one who ever served as a district judge.
I wholly agree. Yeah, that is, even setting aside demographics, that is, you know, gender, race, et cetera, having a broad spectrum of American life, I think, really helps to bring sort of a lot more wisdom to the court. And when you think about a legal education, like we're involved in legal education, right. I like to think that actually, you know, you're forming the beginnings of people's views on the law. So if people are coming from essentially all the same schools, you're not getting that cross-section of ideas.
And there was someone under consideration who I think drove a cab for a while. I mean, it's so interesting. I mean, it's nice to have really smart people sitting on the court, and those are really good law schools. But I think, as you're both saying, it really does impose a kind of limitation on maybe judicial imagination or judicial experience.
And the choices are, both from the left and the right, the choices are very safe. So I have great regard for Judge Kavanaugh. He's a strong choice, but also in many ways a safe choice. He comes from the D.C. Circuit, where also Justice Thomas, Justice Ginsburg, and Chief Justice Roberts came from. Mm-hmm. And there's, I think, a hesitation to, say, go out and appoint a governor or a senator,
Risky?
Too risky, and then there's a kind of a the list itself reflects this. There's mm-hmm. there's a kind of a sorting process that both sides engage in for the kinds of candidates that they're looking for.
Does this choice tell us that elections have consequences?
Yes,
big consequences.
Very, very much, and it's my hope that, given that the stakes appear to be so high in this particular confirmation process, that it alerts the public, the voting public, that in fact they should think about whether to vote and what the consequences of their vote may be in terms of the long range sort of jurisprudence of the country.
I mean, it does depend on the cases that are going to go before the court, how they're going to obviously rule or not. But do you see, again, with this assumption, but it's sort of hard to imagine that he wouldn't get confirmed. But if he is confirmed, do you see really a court that has sort of fought about the middle really taking a right-hand turn?
I think that, well, first of all, a lot of cases that come before the court don't have that immediate ideological 5-4 valence. So it's important to point out that a lot of cases are, you know, pretty routine, often unanimously decided. But in some of the hot-button cases, I think there will be a slight, maybe more conservative move, mm-hmm. although, as Laura pointed out earlier, Justice Kennedy was actually pretty reliably conservative on a range of issues, with a couple of exceptions.
You mentioned the fact, Laura, that you would like to ask a very direct question about Roe v. Wade. Is it fair to ask Kavanaugh about what he thinks about emoluments or the emolument clause, something that we have all learned about in the last year or so?
I mean, certainly his understanding of different parts of the Constitution should be at play in the confirmation hearings. And the fact that it may implicate the future of our president, I don't think should make the senators mm-hmm. hesitate to ask him for his views on that.
I certainly agree that separation of powers issues should and will be a central question that the judiciary community will be talking about. It is, I think, important to point out that this idea of a strong executive, though, that has been a view among conservative legal scholars for decades now. And there is a deep structural reason for that the president is the politically accountable actor at the top of the executive mm-hmm. branch, and that all these administrative agencies that are kind of hemming in presidential power and so forth were a threat to that kind of clear level of political accountability.
And that's a conservative idea.
There are probably liberals who adopt that view too, right. But I'd say it was famously associated with Justice Scalia, for example, and has been, I think, for decades now a pretty central, this idea of sometimes called the unitary executive mm-hmm. idea, the really strong executive idea. In many ways, it goes back to Alexander Hamilton, though. Again, this is not like a new idea.
I can hear the music in my head as you say that. Right. What are your thoughts, Laura?
Well, I, it's ironic or maybe just obvious that it's a concept that is the strong executive that presidents tend to start to really embrace, whether they be conservative or liberal in other ways. So that helps to reinforce the concept, you know, in terms of their interaction with the courts and the Congress.
Do you think a president can pardon himself? Do we know the answer to that?
I think we don't know. We don't know.
Have
the
we ever
that.
Tested that?
No, and there's actually a Justice Department opinion from the Nixon administration that I believe comes out on the view that a president cannot pardon himself. But it's one of these. I don't think there's no clear answer to it.
It seems to me that it would undermine the meaning of the pardon power, and the meaning that the president has an obligation to obey the law.
What do you hope then the Judiciary Committee does? And my understanding is. Now Kavanaugh goes and talks with individual members of the Senate to have a one-on-one. What do you hope the committee does and how it comports itself?
I hope that they ask probing questions, that they don't take just sort of a shield. I can't threaten my impartiality, and therefore I'm not going to answer that question. I hope they don't take that without a struggle. I hope that there's lots of different ideas that are debated and that it's all very much in public. That is not back chambers deals, but rather a real meaningful debate that can inform the public.
And for you, Michael?
I do, too. And I think these confirmation battles are a good sort of civic moment to clarify kind of what we think the role of the court should be, what we think the place of the Constitution is. I was actually a page in the Senate the year that Robert Bork's nomination was defeated. So I was on the Senate floor when his nomination was defeated and Anthony Kennedy's was confirmed. And so I remember these things. and the Bork nomination was this kind of – I think in some ways it was kind of the turning point in how we think about these judicial confirmations. But I do think that – I hope there'll be a vibrant debate. Again, I think there are a lot of things that Judge Kavanaugh, it would be inappropriate for him to weigh in on, for example, whether he's willing to commit himself to not overturning Roe or something like that. But I do think they can be great moments of civic education. That would be my highest hope for it.
And what did a young Michael Moreland think of Robert Bork?
I was sad that he didn't get confirmed.
you were a young Bork fan then. But do you see that as a turning point in this whole process? Laura?
It seemed to send a message that there's very little upside to a nominee being candid. And yes, I do see that as the turning point, and I'd like it to change back.
He was very candid in the hearings. I remember about things he would revisit, about his constitutional methods of interpretation. And I think it was a change because there had been, up till then, a fair amount of deference to president's ability to pick qualified judges, and they were readily confirmed. That was true of Justice Scalia just a year before that, for example. He was confirmed unanimously. And for good or ill, that changed, I think, dramatically with the Bork confirmation battle.
And is the court going to have a busy fall, Laura?
I looked at their docket, and I didn't actually see any real sort of hot button issues. There's very important legal issues that would implicate the stock market and would be very important to particular segments of society, but I didn't see any big constitutional issues.
They've kept the docket pretty light until now, although I suspect with confirmation of new justice that will change.
Well, Laura Little, Michael Moreland, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. Laura Little is a professor of law at Temple University, working on a book about law and comedy. And Michael Moreland is a professor of law at Villanova University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us. We'll